Welcome to That's So Hindu, a podcast brought to you by the Hindu American Foundation. I'm Matt McDermott. What we have for you today is a discussion about yoga, colonialism, attitudes about yoga coming out of the DEI space. And we're going to be using four different articles to frame the discussion, which I'll be moderating. Taking part in this discussion are HAF's Vijay Satnarayan and scholar Shyam Ranganathan. Hope you enjoy it.
Great, thanks. So my day job, I'm a philosophy professor at York University in the York Center for Asian Research. I've been at anti-colonial research into philosophy for about 30 years now. I got interested in this myth that South Asians weren't interested in moral political issues, which is exactly the story you would say propagate to normalize colonial relationships with the colonized tradition. So that's kind of where it all started. Yoga became an area of research interest as I was pursuing this broader question of South Asian moral and political philosophy. I also run Yoga Philosophy, which is a online platform for yoga and philosophy education.
Great. Thanks. Vijay, your nutshell background and how you're coming at this.
Sure. Good morning.
Good morning.
The most pertinent things, I think, is that I'm a trained Indologist and philologist. And in the search of, you know, finding the roots of philology and Indology, I happened across the same issues, I think, that Shyam was just speaking to with regards to colonial interpretations. And more importantly for us, I think, given that everybody who comes from South Asia who has gone to school is basically studying from a colonialist curriculum, how much of that we have internalized and we are projecting onto our own understandings of history and all of the categories that make up the world that we seem to know. My interest is to free ourselves of that, not by saying, let's pick it all up, throw it in a bin, but more, let's critically analyze it and see if we can do a better job of bringing a little bit more diverse voices to the table. Specifically, when it comes to yoga, I think it's a case in point because we have being given one very narrow version of yoga when yoga, in fact, is a lot more vibrant, I think is the word. So I'm sure that will come up in discussion, but it's a little bit of an intro.
It will. There's a quote in one of these articles I think we can use to kick off. But the articles that really, when we were doing the research for this, that seemed to be a good entree into these topics come from Yoga Journal, Yoga International, Sojourners of All Things, which is a Christian publication, and another one, excuse me, Birdie, which I, prior to doing this research, actually had not heard of. But the articles have a very similar theme. There are two that have literally the same title, and I'm not going to share the authors because I don't really want to go at specific authors here. We're talking about the ideas. One is how casteism manifests in yoga spaces. The second one is how casteism manifests in yoga and why it's a problem. And then there's the one, is yoga practice stealing from religion? And then the perennial focus of cultural appropriation, how appropriation of yoga masks violence. That's in Sojourners. So let's start off with the casteism one, because the issue of caste is one that's knotted and complex and is worthy of discussion. There's a very short quote in the first one. Yoga is a microcosm of the socio-political climate of exclusion. It's such a pithy statement. What do you both think about framing yoga in that way? We're talking about not a spiritual practice, not a practice of spiritual liberation, or even just a physical practice as it's become often in the West, but socio-political climate of exclusion.
Yeah. So, I mean, all of these titles, I mean, all of these claims, you can't deal with them responsibly without taking a step back and thinking about methodology that you use to engage in research. That's something that I've really focused on in my work. And because if you have a bad methodology for research, what you do is you just recycle the things that you observe and you've heard. And what you observe and hear in a world of colonization is colonization. So the things that are created by the politics of oppression get reified as explanations of history if you choose a bad methodology. The bad methodology is called interpretation. It's acclaimed in the Western tradition. It's basically the idea that when you explain things, an adequate explanation is provided in terms of your beliefs, what you believe to be true. And one of the things that I noticed is remarkable about this form of explanation is that it violates very basic instruction in critical thinking and logic. Like the first thing we try and teach students is that if you're trying to understand an argument, it's not, you can't understand it in terms of what you believe, because an argument is reasons for a conclusion, and the relationship between the conclusion and the reason is one of inferential support. And really this distinction between, and I call this latter form of explanation, explication, when you render explicit the theories and reasons that lead people to their conclusions. And one of the things that I pointed out is that the reason that the rich history of moral philosophy has been disappeared in the literature by Indologists is that they interpret. So they use their westernized outlook to explain every use of the term dharma, and then they will correlate it with whatever they believe the topic that the use is about. And then it fragments into a million different claims. So then we get very normal claim, dharma means many things, right? But if we explicate, what we do is we look at every perspective and we use logic to extract its theory that entails its claims about dharma. That's step one. And then we further compare all these theories and then deduce from them the topic of dissent. So if you were to do that, you would find that what these competing theories of dharma are disagreeing about is the right or the good, which is the basic question of moral philosophy. Now, why is this relevant? Not only is the myth that South Asians weren't interested in moral philosophy false, because they were madly concerned about dharma and disagreed about it all the time, there's a fourth basic ethical theory in the South Asian tradition that you don't find in the Western tradition. So the three common theories are virtue ethics, the idea that you have to be a good person in order to know what to do. And if you're not, you have to go find a good person to tell you what to do. So theism is a version of virtue ethics. God is the ultimately good person who will tell you what to do. Then there's consequentialism, the idea that, well, there are these good ends and they justify the means. Okay. Then there's deontology, the idea there are lots of good things to do, but some you have special reason to do. And you can find examples of many examples of these in the Western and in the South Asian tradition. But the South Asian tradition has a fourth basic ethical theory that's the opposite of virtue ethics, which is the idea that you have to start with the right, the ideal of the right, sovereignty, Ishra, and then you devote yourself to that ideal of the right, and then you practice those procedures of the ideal of the right, which is what are the essential traits of Ishra? Well, it's unconservatism, not stuck in the past, and self-governance, a freedom to move forward. And this is the Sanskrit is tapas and swadhyaya. And then the good is just the perfection of this practice. So you start off with this devotion to this procedural ideal of the right. And then as you perfect it, you bring about the good. So if you want to look at what yoga has historically, right, I would say, well, what's your methodology? If you're just going to use your beliefs about what yoga is in a colonized world based on what you observed at a yoga studio, like you can do that, but it's stupid. You're just reifying observations. You're not using a logically credible method. If you explicate, you'll see that there is just one theory historically called yoga in the realm of the disagreement. And if you understand what that one theory is, you can understand why various different activities can be ways to practice yoga, asana, pranayama, et cetera, are ways for people to work on their own independence by practicing their own unconservatism and self-governance. But, and this is the really important part, if we do the historical research, we'll see that what people call it yoga today is usually not yoga at all. It's what it is. It's what I call Western appropriated culture, where you take something from South Asia, but you use it to recreate a Western institution, right? So there are kind of two classic Western institutions. There's a Plato Republic Western institution, which is a pyramid scheme with the guru at the top who dictates curriculum. And then learning is about understanding how you fit into the institution and you climb that ladder. So that's the Plato's Republic model. And then there's the Aristotle's ethics model, which is the idea that, well, learning is about being enculturalized in a social context. So that's like going to the ashram or like taking a trip to India to learn. You're like, it's about going native, right? And those are kind of the two models I see of yoga in the contemporary world, but they're not South Asian. They're not indigenous. They're ways of taking South Asian resources and recreating these Western institutions. That's colonialism. That's just what colonialism does. So these comments that people make about yoga are like interesting comments about like the world of colonization. They don't really tell us anything about yoga, if you ask me.
I would add on to that, because the methodological issues lead to implications that are just so wild. Or if I was to just take a look at that and read it, take it at face value, something, and then take it at its deeper value, it's something else, because you have somebody who is claiming here that they know what yoga is in its totality.
Right.
And they've assessed it from, they've assessed it to be exclusivist, but they're actually excluding everybody else who's involved in the world of yoga.
Right.
Just to take aim at whatever small subset of yoga they've been able to study. But I don't know if that is due to an inability to really get to grips with what other types of yoga exist, or a lack of understanding about the historical context, where yoga grew up, how yoga diversified. All of those things, I think, just become outside of the world of the person that is not equipped with the methodological skills to approach something as ancient, as vast as yoga is. And I also really underline what you said, you know, it's not about just saying, oh, yoga is vast, and then just leave it at this amorphous cloud, that it needs some really well-trained Western scholar to tell you what it is. Mm-hmm. But we can tell, I'm sure you could tell, I can tell, there are so many different types of yogas that we can list out. So it's not unknown. So this kind of narrative that is created relies on the lack of precision that is definitely the mainstay of what has been researched so far in the kind of majority of studies that are available to date. It's changing slowly, but I think that up to now, people are still basing their assessments off of elitist institutions from the 20th century.
There's another quote in here that I'd like you to unpack, because I'm going to have most of these questions I'm asking just for both you two and for listeners. I'm being the middleman here and just asking questions. Even if I have ideas about it, but I'm just going to throw it out there and let you guys go at it. From one of the other article, the quote is, most yoga spaces teach the concepts of karma and dharma in their practice, where karma is the idea of what goes around comes around. And dharma highlights the laws that make social order. These two principles have been used to justify discrimination against lower caste people. There's a lot in there. There's the use of the word most. I don't know if most yoga spaces do that. And do you think that how is the modern yoga practice, or even the bigger tradition, being interpreted there? How do you get from that to discrimination against lower caste people? And what do you think the take, a more proper take on it would be? Whoever would like to jump in, you're both, we're on Zoom right now, and everyone's well, nodding at one another.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, most yoga spaces are places where yoga education is run by people who don't know what they're talking about. But I think we need to first appreciate that. Like, I'm a South Asianist. I'm an analytic philosopher. I'm a translation expert. I've had like basically two academic careers. I've been at this at 30 years. I'm still learning. I look at the people who teach in yoga studios, who took a 200-hour or 500-hour, who, like, on the basis of what are they explaining anything, right? It blows my mind. These are people, we all start someplace, but to treat these spaces as though they are kind of paradigms of, like, knowledge seems, like, bizarre. So I can't say what is said in every yoga context, but to think that somehow that's worth, like, holding up as an example of yoga is very strange. You basically have to credit these spaces with like knowledge, which they lack. I mean, most Indologists have no, I mean, that's my career has been pointing out that most people who write in Indologic have no clue about the South Asian tradition because they interpret, they use their Western outlook to explain. I mean, I can give you so many examples, like the idea of Hinduism. my ancestors never called themselves Hindu until the British showed up, right? Then all of a sudden we're all Hindus. And then it took me a long time to deconstruct that, right? My ancestors were concerned about something else. They were concerned about disagreements about the right or the good. And yet when you, and religion, who made up the idea of religion? It was the Romans. And then as Western colonialism spreads, it deals with BIPOC traditions by isolating them and calling them religions. And that's just a way to basically take them out of the secular world so they can't provide criticisms of white supremacy, right? And so this gets institutionalized on a global level. But what do you find in indulging South Asian studies? People reading back into the history, these stupid colonial categories like Hindu law, right? Just bizarre ideas that it wasn't invented until the British showed up, right? So, I mean, even when the people who are supposed to know don't know, it's very sad when I look at these kind of places lower down the epistemic change. Like they really don't have, you really have to do this kind of work yourself because no one's there to, unless you luck out, no one's going to point you in the right direction. So just with respect to karma and dharma, karma means action. Dharma is the basic concept of the right or the good. I'm sure some people have weird theories about the right or the good where they discriminate. But like when you realize it's just a basic concept that you could use for various purposes, right? You should ask the question, well, what does yoga teach us about these concepts? And it's radical and deconstructive. Yoga is just this completely disruptive practice because you're not interested in reifying the world that as you see it as a yoga practitioner. As you practice your devotional exercise, you change it into one that's friendly to autonomous individuals, right? And autonomy is not a concept that's consistent with discrimination. So, I mean, there's just so much ignorance in these spaces. And it's really weird that these are treated as places of knowledge anyways.
So, Vijay, let me jump in there for one sec.
Sure.
I mean, when I read that, I have no doubt that people in their own interpretation of karma and dharma, what these words mean and concepts mean, have used them to justify discrimination. But when I read that, that statement is, how to put it, it's using individual examples to tar a whole tradition as mm-hmm. believing one thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, is that actually what the whole tradition believes? Or is that the primary, is that at the core of it? And I go, no.
Yeah. Sorry, just that was my point. Like the only reason, like you could only jump to that conclusion if you thought that these yoga spaces were places of knowledge.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, exactly what you highlighted, Shambhi. I think that one of the things that I was taught when I was studying traditionally in India was that you have to be humble. Now, I must make it clear that I studied at some really old places that exist outside of this imperialistic world. And they were very clear in the sense that you must have humility. You must know how much you can answer. And you must know to say to people that I don't know the actual full depths of this. And I'm not going to give you my interpretation as you were speaking about. I'm not going to give you information that is laden with some kind of biases. You know, the Taittiriya Upanishad is very clear about when you give information, you give it without any kind of bias, as much as is possible. And I think that this is a case in point, again, about what happens when people who don't have enough information use what they presume to be right. They're working up basically high school level world religion classes, understanding of you've got what, five times worse of colonialism right in that statement.
Yeah,
to just state things. And because they have the money, they have the power, what they're saying there is going to have so much wider reach than what actual practitioners of yoga. I mean, this is so egregious. Abhinav Gupta, Trika Yoga, Trika Shaiva, absolute mastermind when it comes to yoga. He said, you all are Shakta practitioners, speaking to his disciples, you all are Shakta practitioners. And we're not even talking about caste, we're talking about jati. He says, don't think that you can come to Shakta spaces and practice for the pleasure of Devi with the ghost of jati possessing you. exorcise the ghost of Jati before you come in front of Devi. That's his own words. That's 1,000 years ago plus in Kashmir, right? So this just goes to keep this elitist nonsense alive, which is elite people pointing out to other people they think are elite and saying that you're bad. I just don't get this.
Yeah, I just another example. I just finished writing about this. The Sri Vaishnava tradition is also a pre-colonial tradition. It's also deeply connected with yoga, bhakti. And if you look at the first human teacher in this tradition, it's an abandoned child from a low caste who ends up being the first in the Guru Parampara of the entire, like aside from Vishnu, there's no other teacher than Namarvar. And then he attracts a disciple, which is an elderly Brahmin. And then amongst the Arwars, who are these kind of very ancient group of people, of devotional practitioners, there are people of all sorts of castes and outcasts, etc. But the reason they are our examples is because they lived life on their own terms, not because they lived life in terms of social conformity or in accordance with other people's expectations. That's why there are exemplars, right? And I look at the yoga tradition is about this kind of strong individuality and then respecting that in others too, that dignity that's theirs.
Yeah, and I mean, don't you think it's like they are just, these kinds of commentators just eviscerate from the historical record the voices of these so important people?
Yeah, they have no clue. Because this is what interpretation does. If you're an interpreter, you open your eyes, you observe things, and then that's your explanation, right? So it's completely ahistorical. It treats the outcomes of oppressive political orders in our world, Western colonialism, as the explanation for history. So it gets everything backwards. So all these people, they just kind of look at the things that are proximate to them, which are an outcome of colonialism, and then think that that explains the tradition. And they don't realize, no, what they're seeing is a violence that's been done to the tradition. Sorry. Thank you, Vijay.
That discussion brings me to another. I realize we're circling the same thing. I've got a number of quotes that get at this, but I think it's still useful. From one of the ones on casteism, it says the practice, referring to the yoga practices defined here, through ancient spiritual hierarchies, continues to subjugate South Asians. Skipping ahead, is an imperative to acknowledge and uncover the contradictions that lie within yoga. One, do you think that the yoga practice today, as flawed as it may be, or lacking in authentic or deep knowledge, does continue to subjugate South Asians? And where does that come from?
Sure. I mean, I've got a couple of initial quotes. Then Sham, please go ahead and elaborate. Unfortunately, they've been told that yoga is only what Patanjali wrote in the Yoga Sutras. And because Patanjali chose to write in Sanskrit, and their equation is that Sanskrit is a higher caste supremacist language, that all of yoga must be high caste supremacist. I disagree vehemently that Sanskrit is a higher caste language only. There are so many different things that have survived in tradition that will suggest very clearly that everybody who wanted to get an idea across to use language as the lingua franca of a basically, I mean, two or 3,000 tribe different area of geography of the world, A. And B, I'm sorry, I've never seen yogis spoken of as, Brahmins in any of the texts that survive in the Mimamsa world or in the Smartha world. There is another issue that yoga exists to escape any of those classist or endogamous classist worlds that were created by later South Asian empires. They stand outside. Am I going to tell Ramanandis, who have the variety and uplift the voices of some of the most downtrodden sections of society, am I going to tell those Ramanandi yogis that you guys are actually supremacists, that you don't know what you're practicing? I'm sorry. I would rather keep these voices alive. I'm not going to put my passion behind this anymore. I'm going to try to speak a little bit dispassionately and say, to me, as someone who inherits tribal traditions as well as Mimamsaka traditions, that I would like to see these voices be included in these people's assessments when they're saying that we're trying to equalize everything, we're trying to provide equity. Well, then really provide some equity by studying everything, not just a narrow thing.
Why do you think those voices are excluded then? Is it a lack of knowledge or is it, or what?
I mean, it's just very convenient. It's very convenient to position yourself as the yoga teacher and that you know and you have the authority. The moment that you admit that you don't have enough knowledge about, say, how Santalis do spiritual practice, which if you act by actual yoga teaching on top of what Santali tradition does or Sarna Dharma does, they are doing a form of yoga. So the moment they say, I don't know enough about this, and I need to go and research, they immediately undermine their notions of what makes them authoritative in their tradition. But yes, I turn over to Sham. I'm sure you have some thoughts.
Oh, no, thank you. I was actually so confused by that quote. I mean, I think I was confused by that quote because people do... I think there's a really weird view, and I think this is because of... Western colonization. At the roots of the Western tradition is this idea that like thought is about language. And so that if you have a change in linguistic use, then somehow things have changed, right? So people use the word yoga in a colonized world differently than they would have pre-colonially. And then this is then treated as like both a change in yoga, but also yoga. So that what we're seeing now is actually yoga. And I never know why people would believe it. So just because I use the word mouse for a computer pointing device does not mean that mice have changed or evolved. So I can kind of use the word yoga in any stupid way I choose. It doesn't mean that I'm actually tracking yoga, right? So to Vijay's point, like if you really want to open your mouth, you got to do a lot of research, a lot of work. And like, I have to, like, once again, I've been at this for 3 decades. There's so much I don't know. You know, I'm an expert in South Asian moral philosophy and decolonialism, but like, there's just tons I don't know, right? I can muck through Sanskrit. I have kitchen Tamil. There's like so much, there's so many languages in which this tradition has been taught and shared. And I don't know why. So the way I deal with this problem of just the immense, the size of the data is I think, well, what's the basic disagreement about? I try and kind of simplify it. Like, when yoga is an option and it's not every option, right? And in the tradition, people would choose what option they wanted. And when I look historically, yoga had to do with this idea of Ishvara Pranidhana, devotion of sovereignty. And if that's your core, you're not going to be for hierarchy and discrimination because you're going to think independence is like a basic value. Everybody should be somehow sovereign and independent. And so when I don't know, it's just so weird. There's just the bizarre kind of lack of knowledge, this sense of entitlement to this stupidity as though that's knowledge, right? And then just also this, it's tragic in a way, right? It's just I find it tragic. People are just victims of their own ignorance here.
Vijay, anything to add on that? You're nodding along. And
I'm in definite consonance there. And, you know, the word karma, you sit there and you try to tell Anathyogi that predetermination is the essence of what karma is. I think Anathyogi will throw you off the mountain they're sat on. The Anathyogi will say karma is a empowering doctrine that says that just because you're facing situation X, Y, or Z doesn't mean that you have to sit there and take the slap of that situation. You can get up and do something about it.
Right.
It's not going to deign to say that this is why you got there. It's going to say that you might want to examine the causes of how you got there, but it's an empowering thing. For it to be reduced to this what goes around comes around, it's just because it's intelligible. I don't know, Shram, if you ever came across it like this, but my professor of Indology who I learned from said that before he became atheist, his the person that taught him was a pastor. And he said that actually he admired this pastor for saying this one thing. He said, because a lot of these people, when they were translating originally, their worldview was based in the Bible. Mm. They assumed immediately that when they saw people giving reverence and veneration or thanks, I would say gratitude to cows once in a while, because that was their mainstay, that they immediately linked it to when Moses came down off the mountain and found that his people had stopped worshiping Yah, El, and instead were worshiping the golden bull, and immediately said, look, these are those heathens, and it's our duty to bring them back to the path. So it's this using their worldview now. The worldview now of these kinds of commentators is this elitist, us versus them, oppressor and subjugated kind of dichotomy. Yeah. And they're just projecting it like mad on top of something as liberating as karma. And I will say this really, really clearly. The amount of traditions, the proliferation of traditions that we have in South Asia that use karma to get over any kind of materialistic stratification or social convention, it just wipes them off the map. And I can't understand it.
Karma's action. Action's something you do. It's not something that happens to you. It's something you do. So that means it's an affirmation of your agency. It's really weird that the story becomes this depersonalized thing that happens to you. That's not what action is.
Right. It's treated as if it's the original sin for the Western world.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yes. Well, see, I mean, this is the thing about, like, when you realize something's your fault, you're actually empowered. Like, I think this is what this tradition, that means you can change it, right? Like, when you realize you made a mistake, okay, now change it. That's a very empowering insight. People are scared often to embrace that power because they think that defines them in terms of their mistake. That's not what this tradition teaches you, but this is part of the Western baggage, right? I think the virtue ethics, where you think about yourself in terms of your character, it problematizes this idea of moral reformation. Because if you're bad enough to make that mistake in the past, then you're always bad. So people don't want to, I think when they have that baggage, especially coming from theistic traditions, it's very difficult for them to see that how empowering this is.
So one theme that's come through both of your answers seems to me is that people have both a lack of depth of knowledge, and the knowledge they have is inauthentic, or it's not sufficient to answer the questions. So how can people now, how can we both learn more in an authentic way and get past some of these issues, these questions that keep coming up in these articles that seem to be taking or projecting modern concerns about discrimination onto an ancient tradition and then tarring the whole tradition as a whole with those misconceptions? How can we get past that?
I actually find this a very difficult question to answer, because I think what people want in the way of learning is exactly the problem. They want to go find someone who will tell them the answers, as opposed to develop the kind of research skills that you need to not buy the stupid, right? So if you don't have those research skills, then you're just going to believe the next stupid thing that comes along. So I think it comes down to this. In our world, in a Western colonized world, as I mentioned earlier, the West is really based on this idea of thought as language. Goes back to the ancient Greek idea of logos. And so this sets up an idea that knowledge is about social transmission. And the interesting thing about the South Asian tradition is that all these leaders, these ancient philosophers, they would break with their social groups to go experiment, try new things, learn from different people. It wasn't just about repeating what mommy and daddy told you. Like, you had to go out and do the work yourself, and you had to learn, you had to reform yourself. But now what people want is they want to just be told. They think that authentic knowledge is just going to find some South Asian and listen to them. I was born, I didn't know anything growing up. Like, I had to do a lot of work to get to where I am. And a lot of that had to do with coming to appreciate the ways in which my own upbringing was a result of colonial trauma. The things that I was taught as just kind of basic to my understanding of my tradition, that there's a top layer of Westernization I have to peel off before I could start to appreciate the wisdom underneath. So I think until people are willing to invest in these research skills, we're not going to move the needle. But that means like a higher respect for research and not stupid. But people just want, you know, they just want to go read some book by some Indologist who has no research skills, right? But they know Sanskrit. I guess that's the thing that drives me nuts. This is also a symptom of Westernization, because everything's about language. People think that if someone knows Sanskrit, they must know what they're talking about. My students can all understand English. They can't understand the philosophy I put in front of them in English until a very long time. And even then, I reread things all the time written in English, and I'm still learning from the classics, right? So the idea that somehow cultural and linguistic competence is sufficient is a huge problem, because that sets up this really bizarre idea that you just have to go find someone who grew up on an ashram, knows Sanskrit, can go as native as possible, right? And pretend to be a South Asian. They must know. No, because the knowledge was never about enculturalization. This is something more important than just like, do you use the fork with the right hand or the left hand, right? This yoga is not, you know, this kind of philosophical knowledge is not about social etiquette. But you do learn from it by enculturalization.
Well, that's a point I hadn't considered about the enculturalization that goes along with it, because I've been so much into finding things out and talking to people and going beyond. When I realized the limits of the page, especially the pages we've been handed and fed and thought our own, and I started to go out and ask people who are not affected too much by this, it's so interesting the variety of things that you get. Look, first thing I would say is that it takes determination. It takes a little bit of effort. It takes a little bit of stamina. You can't expect to become a master of anything. You know, even with neuroplasticity, everybody talking about 10,000 hours it takes to get a skill. Sure, great. It does take a long time, but that doesn't mean that it is completely unfathomable and only certain people are great. I mean, again, this is just more elitism in a new form. Take your time, approach someone. You know, you've got people like Shamji, you've got people who actually know stuff that are available to people. To find professors in reputable universities these days who have some competency. We are so lucky to be alive at this time, because if it was only 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that was not necessarily the case, that you'd find a few people around. I'm going to say it again, it is a few people, because only a few people have taken the time to go through the translation stuff, go through the history stuff, go through the sociology stuff, go through the philosophical stuff, and realize that actually in South Asia, instead of being siloed, all of these were interlinked, woven together. So I'd say that's one consideration from my mind. And the second consideration from my mind is just, how would I say it? Sanskrit is great. And also, a lot of texts that people consider as foundational to the practice of yoga today were composed centuries after Jnaneshwar composed his Marathi Jnaneshwari. It was composed, I want to hesitate and say, millennia after the Kiratis of Nepal and Sikkim nowadays were discussing what they call now Kirat Koveda, but obviously had its own words in their language, where they're talking about the spiritual practices that one uses to become a dhami. And those spiritual practices, if I was to look at it from the eyes of yoga, I'd say, yeah, these are definitely in the realm of yoga. So going beyond what we've blinkered ourselves into thinking is right is the first step to becoming equitable. It's the first step to becoming a real expert. And it's the first step to forget even expertise or being equitable, just realizing how vast yoga is and being appreciative of it rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater just because they've accepted what a couple of Indologists have said. And what is, I want to be honest here, it's what has been reinforced in all kinds of media, whether it be Indian movies from Bollywood, which we must realize are colonized productions, or whether it be what a few of our, you know, our fellow compatriots or fellow people with my skin color say in this country. It's beyond all of that. But it's not unknowable. Just takes a first step.
That's a great answer. Thank you. Like I said, this question, I always freeze. Thank you.
Well, then, let's wrap this up. I realize my questions probably have left big gaps. One final thought on what we haven't covered, what we should have said about this, what I should have asked from each of you. And then if you could just end that, let's go start with Vijay. So Shyam gets the final word on this, not being the HIF staff member, and where we can find you, people could follow you, people can read more.
You know, I don't want to be the the one that says a cliche thing that there's so much. In the case of yoga, there really is a lot. Again, it's not unknowable. I think personally, what for me was really interesting was discovering that, yes, there is this notion of bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, karma yoga, raja yoga that we've gotten taught is the only, types of yoga out there. But going beyond it and seeing, well, hatha yoga is a thing. Where did hatha yoga come from? Well, there was interactions of Shaktas and Buddhists, Vajrayana Buddhists. Oh, Buddhists are in there? Were the Jains in there? Of course the Jains were in there too. Just realizing the absolute multiplicity that was responsible for the discussions around yoga, vibrancy around yoga, the vibrant discussions that happened because of yogic practitioners. That I think is just something to look at. And I think another thing that would be really interesting to look at is how judgment was suspended until people were allowed to bring to the table the reasoning behind their points of view. Before it was accepted as Siddhanta, Siddhanta is talked about a lot in the yogic commentary. And how people arrived at that, how they were able to hold sometimes really opposite and conflicting viewpoints and have discussions around it. I think that's also a part of history that yoga had a really big hand in. And I think we don't get to cover that a lot, but that's just my couple of things. I love the fact that the yoga that I eventually latched onto comes through Kashmir, because that's also where my spiritual tradition comes from. And I wish people get to know the variety that's out there. That's all. So yes, I'm at HAF. You can always email me here.
Great. Sean.
Thanks. So thanks for including me in this conversation. I guess my one lament, but this is also something can be corrected, is that kind of one of the root functions of Western colonization is the oppression of philosophy. It's the only tradition that begins with the murder of a philosopher and then continues killing public intellectuals. So different from South Asia, where a philosopher was someone who's celebrated. And then it creates this story. Oh, well, those BIPOC, they weren't doing philosophy. They were doing religion. Bizarre. Right. It's a tradition that oppresses intellectual activity and then redefines BIPOC philosophy as something spiritual outside the realm of public reasoning on purpose to keep it insulated from criticism response. So I think the most decolonial activity you can do is to learn philosophy. Actually learn how to reason. It's not popular, though. I find it really interesting. People who are interested in yoga, they want to say that it's like inessential. I find people get very exasperated by the very idea that, like, no, you should start there. I think we all should, because that's the most decolonial activity we could do. And then it also helps simplify things, because while there is this remarkable diversity in practice, there just comes down to like a handful of disagreements, right? And when you can start looking at things as basic disagreements, you have a way of simplifying data that's just huge. That's kind of one of the gifts that philosophy gives. It's also given me, it's allowed me to think about traditions over millennia without blowing my head off, because I look at it in terms of, well, what is the disagreement? What are the changes in the disagreements, right? That simplifies things. So, and I also think it's just so South Asian. So if you really want to respect the tradition, learn philosophy, because that's just what our ancestors were. They were the South Asians. They were philosophers. You can find me at yogaphilosophy.com. on Instagram, yogaphilosophy_com. And you can contact me there.
Well, that's it for this episode of That's So Hindu. If you enjoyed it, please take a minute and leave us a nice 5-star review. It's how you can help the show get discovered by more listeners. You can help ensure that more of these get made by making a donation to HAF at hinduamerican.org/donate. Thanks again for listening.